Hello and welcome to today's Ask the Experts on Strengthening National Policy Systems, Bridging the Disconnect Between the Evidence and Action for Food Security. This is a special event affiliated with AgriLink's Food Security Policy Month this June. My name is April Thompson. I'm the Knowledge Management Portfolio Manager here at the Knowledge-Driven Agricultural Development Project, which oversees AgriLinks, among other knowledge-sharing platforms. I'm excited to be facilitating today's discussion featuring Suresh Babu, a senior fellow at IFPRI, along with Duncan Boughton from Michigan State University. Before I introduce our featured guest experts, I'm just going to quickly go over how today's event will work. We've gotten a number of great questions already from our registrants, which I'll be reading out to Suresh along with a few questions of my own. We also encourage you to type in questions and comments in the chat box, as our online facilitators will be selecting questions from there to also post throughout the event, provided we've got time to get through it all. This is a short format, so we will try to keep it to the half hour allotted. So with that, I'd like to introduce our featured expert, Suresh Babu, a senior fellow and a program leader at the International Food Policy Research Institute in Washington, D.C. He's also a professor of agricultural economics at the University of Pretoria in South Africa. Previously a research economist at Cornell University, Suresh has published 20 books and monographs and over 90 peer-reviewed journal papers on food and agricultural policies in developing countries. He's currently engaged in research on strengthening agricultural policy, research, and extension institutions, and strengthening the capacity of the policy and researchers and analysts in India, Myanmar, Bangladesh, Brazil, Malawi, and Nigeria. In fact, he just arrived from Malawi, I believe, last night. also here to answer your questions in the chat box, we've got Duncan Boughton, who's a professor at Michigan State University. Duncan directs the USAID Burma and LIFT-funded Food Security Policy Project in collaboration with IFPRI. He has over 30 years professional experience on agricultural research and technology transfer for smallholder farmers, value chain development, policy analysis, and outreach to host country senior government decision makers, and capacity building of local staff. Duncan and Suresh, welcome to AgriLinks and today's Ask the Expert. We're really happy to have you here. So Suresh, just to dive in, to kind of a core question to our event today, which is why, with so much research and analysis, is the policymaking process so seldom evidence-based?
First of all, let me thank you, April and Julie, for organizing this session. It's an important topic that that people would want to have some answers, because researchers do research and publish in academic journals and many other ways, and then they wonder why the research is not taken up by the policymakers. And some are taken up by the policymakers, particularly when they are relevant for the decision-making process. So that tells us something, that if your research is relevant for policymaking, then there is a demand for it. But if you conduct research that is not connected to the policy-making process or does not provide evidence to the policy-making system, then sometimes it is ignored because it's not the right time. Even with a particular research that is addressing a problem that the policymaker is facing, it may not be the right stage of the policy process. That's why we say we should understand the policy process. The research that we have been doing with IFPRI colleagues, International Food Policy Research Institute and Michigan State and others, University of Pretoria, did look into how can we understand the policy process itself so that the research that we conduct can be made relevant for policymaking, not only in the whole policy reform process, but also at every stage of policymaking process.
Great. So obviously, as you say, the research has to be relevant to be incorporated, but what are kind of some of the key constraints that policymakers face to incorporate evidence in decision-making, assuming that the evidence they're being presented with is relevant?
Even if the policy research that we do is relevant for the policymaking process, sometimes policymakers face several constraints. Well, first constraint is research itself gives wide-ranging recommendations. Research methods differ, the data set differs to address the same question. So the research may not be really very specific in terms of the recommendation. That's one aspect of it. Then who is producing this research and evidence? The credibility of the people who produce the research and evidence is important. In some countries, policymakers want the local research community to produce this research, and that is where the capacity constraint comes in. We do not have adequate human capacity or the institutional capacity to produce the local research through the local, and the external collaboration with the people like us, if PRI or MSU or University of Pretoria, helps in that process. But eventually, the credibility of the research as well as the capacity to produce local research that can be trusted by the policymakers is very important. And in addition to that, there is always the political economy issue of policymaking. Even if the research is relevant, even if it produces the evidence that shows that taking action 1, 2, 3 is going to improve the economy or improve the welfare of the people, there is hesitation in terms of making that research useful for policymaking, because the research usually comes up with the first best solution. And research and policymakers are looking for not that all the time first best solution, but the second best or the third best, and sometimes we miss out on that process, and that's what we are finding out from our research on policy process. And in addition to that, there may be constraints in terms of who is losing, who is winning. Understanding that is important, and that helps the policymakers to see whether the evidence can be used in that particular point in time in the process where they are in the policy process.
Great. Well, we had a question from a registrant that actually ties into something you were mentioning in terms of the trust in the research evidence itself, which can be a constraint. And this person wanted to know if there are practices that can enhance policymaker confidence in research evidence, and can these help lead to more policy action changes?
That's wonderful. I mean, in order to build the confidence of the policymakers on the research that we do, it's not enough to publish the papers and write policy briefs and then send them, so that it lands on the desk. It is important to connect with the policymakers as researchers or the people who produce evidence. Need to connect with the policymakers from the beginning of the policy process, right? And even when the problem is being talked about, even before the problem comes into the policy agenda, we need to communicate and gain the confidence of the policymakers. That requires a lot of work. It is not just to fly in and collect the data and analyze the data and send the report. It is how do you sit with the policymakers, develop trust in the beginning, and show the credibility of your research in the past and how you have done that kind of research in other countries, and what do you bring to the table in terms of working in that particular country, in that particular context in which they are facing the policy problem. And what also helps is to work collaboratively with the local researchers to build their credibility and their capacity, so that when you are done with the research, which may be of global interest, but the in-country capacity that is built through the research program, in all our programs we do that, is helpful in terms of taking the research and applying in the local context so that they can be continuously advising the countries. And that sometimes is missing in large research programs, because people don't have time to build local capacity. And that kind of research is sometimes is not really taken seriously, because it stays in the journal papers and publications and so on.
So that's a great point in terms of the capacity building really needed to be able to enhance the role of evidence in policy making. What are some of those capacities, and how can they be incorporated and built at the national level?
Okay, some examples of the capacity that we have been working on under the FSP Innovation Lab is to strengthen the national capacities for policy analysis. Say, for example, where Duncan, my colleague who is joining from Myanmar, we have been working in Myanmar to build the national capacity of the policy system as a whole. To be started with the Ministry of Agriculture, where we set up an agriculture policy unit and identified the key policy analysts there in order to give them the exposure of various methods of policy analysis. That really helps when it comes for them to pick up the global results and convert that into really usable information for policy making within the system. And it's not enough to strengthen the policy capacity of the policy analyst. We need to look at the other actors and players in the policy process and policy system. For example, we have been working with University of Pretoria to strengthen the capacity of the journalists in Malawi. What does it mean? The when you strengthen the capacity of the journalists to understand the issues related to food security, issues related to climate change and resilience and so on, they are able to report based on the results that we have done and take that results and report that in a way that is easily used by the policymaking system. So you see these research results are assimilated in a very nice, simple English in the newspaper. So it attracts the policymaker, parliamentarians, and it can create the debate within the policy system. So not just policy analysts, but also other actors and players in the policy system as well. But policy communication is an important aspect of making things happen through policy research. It is not just publishing papers, but how do you convert that into policy briefs, policy memos? Sometimes we need to train the local colleagues and collaborators that we work with to produce policy memos and policy briefs. Now we are into the modern age of social media. How do you connect with LinkedIn and Twitter and Instagram, and how do you reach policymakers to find what you have done in terms of using that research in that policymaking process? But having said that, it is still important that one-on-one communication, researchers meeting the policymakers, researchers meeting the key actors and players in the policy system, and strengthening their capacity to understand the policy is fundamental for making policy impact on the ground.
Great. Well, I wonder, you know, in terms of facilitating it's coordination, you know, you have a good point, you know, across the system, that isn't just the policymakers, it's journalists, et cetera. But in enacting one policy, you may need to really coordinate among multiple authorities to really be effective. And any advice on how to go about that to sort of influence policy outcomes by sort of breaking down those silos?
April, it's a great question, because several of the policy issues that we deal with doesn't squarely fit in one sector. I'll give an example. Take, for example, we want to address the nutrition, malnutrition problem, right? Whether it is overnutrition, undernutrition, micronutrient, malnutrition. We have been looking at the micronutrient policy process, for example, in Malawi, and what has happened in the last 25 years, and who are the key actors and players who have contributed to policy making in nutrition sector. Malawi just released its multi-sectoral nutrition policy after several years of under-preparation. When we looked at that policy process, what we find is it's not just the Ministry of Health, which is now hosting the Department of Nutrition, but other ministries such as agricultural sector, water sector, sanitation sector, they all have to come together in order to contribute to the nutrition goal. But when you have one sector hosting nutrition as the subject matter, it becomes difficult for multi-sector coordination. So that is where understanding of who are the actors and players in the policy process, what authority they have, what convening power they have in terms of bringing the people together for open dialogue and discussion, how do we enhance that capacity of convening through providing or empowering certain departments becomes important. And sometimes we ignore that aspect of institutional architecture. We ignore the aspect of institutional building, and we ignore the aspect of institutional coordination at the national level. And what amount of research we do then becomes not very effective in terms of making things happen on the ground, because the coordination of the multi-sectoral challenges such as nutrition or climate change, for example, or resilience building, they are all multi-sectoral issues. Now we are talking about food system change for and building resilience of the food system. That's inherently multi-sectoral issue that involves production, it involves trade, it involves the drought management ministry or the unit, and also food safety, value chains. They all have to come together in order to strengthen the resilience of the food system. But how are we going to bring that together? So now we have to move away from the single sector approach to problem solving for policy to a multi-sectoral approach. That requires not just doing research on multi-sectoral issues, but also strengthening the capacity for multi-sectoral leadership, strengthening the capacity for multi-sectoral understanding of the food system, in this case, for example, and building that capacity in the country level so that context-specific food system approach to resilience, for example, can be understood and made into research evidence for policymaking.
I'm going to put you on the spot here and see if you have an example of where you think this has been done well.
Well, we are currently working, Professor Duncan Boughton is online. We have been working in Myanmar, for example, in the last 3 to 4 years, trying to bring the public sector, private sector, and also the NGO sector, which is growing in Myanmar, under the program called LIFT, working with USAID colleagues there. And we find that it is important that we bring these people together in order to even develop the agricultural strategy collectively so that they understand. Now, recently we have been looking at how the nutrition goals can be achieved through transformation of the food system, which inherently brings the health ministry, trade ministry, health ministry, and agriculture and food safety issues into bearing. So we brought people together and discussed about what are the investment priorities when you look at the food system as a whole, not just the production aspect of it, not just the irrigation aspect of it, not just the market aspect of it. You have to create an investment plan to address the multi-sectoral aspects of food system contribution to nutrition, how the investment plan should be different compared to the single sectoral investment plan, and who will contribute to that? Who are the actors and players will come and do the implementation once you have the strategy? And that's not been done in many countries. It's just the operational issues have not been looked at seriously. We worry about the problem solving in terms of research. To some extent, we want to strengthen the capacity. But really, how do you operationalize the concept like food system approach to resilience in our food systems approach to nutrition problem solving in the national level is something that we need to research on, and we are working on it under this program.
Great, thanks. Well, I want to turn to another question from one of our registrants, which this person was wondering about how long on average it takes to get policy reforms through these various stages to full and effective implementation.
Well, that's an interesting question, April, because some policies are made by the stroke of a pen. Okay, so the Prime Minister wakes up one day and say, I see this problem and I need to solve this problem, and all I can do is to just, you know, say that these things have to change from today onwards. I mean, those are the policies that happen overnight, right? And some examples of the macro policies such as exchange rate policies, demonetization kind of policies, solving the black money in a country, for example. Those are the policies people really quickly make, and they want to show the impact quickly on the ground, right? On the other hand, there are policies which are driven by the emergencies, such as drought and floods and so on. And these are the policies that we call food crisis-related policies, and they push the policymakers to make policies. In the kaleidoscope model of policy process that we have been studying, we also study what type of policy crisis or policy environment that pushes policymakers to make policies in different time frames, right? So there is this emergency-oriented policies, also short-term policies. I mean, there is this short-term to medium-term policies, which are like fertilizer subsidies. You can change them year by year, but also you can slowly phase them out in 2 to 3, 4 years time period. That requires a time period of 2 to 5 years, for example, if you have to work through that. There are long-term policies. Now we are talking about the SDGs. Mm-hmm. We are setting the goals for 2030, right? So 17 sustainable development goals. In order to achieve that, you need to have a long-term, you know, structural transformation of the economy, and policies related to that take time, transformation of the economy. But then those long-term policies can also result in what do we do in the next 5 years in terms of agricultural sector change. And to give an example that we worked in Nigeria, colleagues with Nigeria, is that Nigeria had a previous government had a long-term economic transformation program. So as a derivative of that, what would the agriculture sector do? So we had an agricultural transformation agenda, and we worked on with USAID funding and colleagues there, mission colleagues there, to identify the capacity needs for transformation of the agricultural sector. And then you work down to see what are the investment needs in order to get to that level of capacity, and so that transformation can take off in different value chains that you are working on. That's an example of a medium-term policy derived from a long-term policy, and then working on a day-to-day investment plans and actors and players centering themselves to contribute to that.
Great. I want to turn to a question that just came in from one of our participants, Chris Shepherd Pratt, who wants to know, what are a couple of the most common misconceptions about getting countries to adopt and implement evidence-based policy, or otherwise put, mistakes that stakeholders make in advocating for evidence-based policy change? Is there anything that's sort of surprised you about the research that you've undertaken in this?
Well, it's a great question because, you know, researchers and people who generate evidence in general, they assume that once you generate evidence and put it out there, somebody will pick it up and use it. That's the largest, to me, it's a huge misconception about that, right? It's not going to be automatic, and you need to be consciously working within the country to see who are the actors and players who are interested in this policy reform, who are the opponents of the policy, who are the proponents of the policy, who are the policy champions, and how can we strengthen them if this policy, the evidence that we have, is going to help them either way, whether to bring down a bad policy, right? And there may be opponents and policy champions may be working on that, or there may be a set of champions working on a positive policy to change the policy on the positive. Both requires evidence and understanding the, not just who are the actors and players, but what are their capacities, how are they connected to policymaking system. And we rarely do this kind of analysis as researchers. And that's why the research that we did under this FSP program on kaleidoscope modeling of policy process, really, the case studies that we produced helped us to understand what are the capacity weaknesses of these people and how can we feed this information to them. The other misconception is that this local capacity is always there to translate what you do at the global level. It is not. We assume that the capacity is there. Local institutions are just waiting for us to give the results to them, right? And it's not happening because they are under, you know, policy process and whatever they have to do, and they run around meetings and workshops and so on, and they don't even have sometimes to sit down and convert the research that you do into a policy memo for the minister. So that's where we need to target what we call strategic policy communication, strengthen that communication skill that is not there in the local level in order to take the research that we do. The third misconception is that we are now into social media and we say, if we can tweet this and the minister there is going to get it. First of all, he's not following you, and probably he's not even on Twitter or Facebook or whatever social media you're using, right, or LinkedIn. But we need to identify what are the methods in which the policymakers are absorbing the information. It's not journal article for sure, but what is a policy memo that we can write, policy blogs that we can write, and how do we get it to the table, and how do we get the attention of the policy makers for the research that you have done, so that the information that you have produced as evidence can get into the policymaking process.
Okay, so you've talked a little about capacity and communications and the importance of that. And this is a question from someone in the audience here. What are some of the other capacities? Are you talking about technical capacity only? Are we talking administrative or financial capacity as well? Maybe you can kind of go into some of those core competencies that you see as important to translating this evidence.
Wonderful. I think the higher education institutions in the developing countries that we are working with have a larger role to play in strengthening the policy system. And we have not effectively used them, partly because they don't themselves have the capacity to connect to the policymakers. And sometimes the quality of research that they do is not up to the mark, so the policymakers within their own countries do not take the policy researchers who do the research in their own countries seriously. So you have the issue of not only increasing the quantity of policy analysts and researchers in the national system, but also strengthening their capacity to produce quality outputs. So what are the incentives for them to produce quality output, and how are we going to recognize them for that? And that's by working jointly with them, collaboratively, to strengthen the capacity in the long run. Sometimes we see the capacity development as a short-term kind of effort solution, and it is not. It's a long-term 20-year, 30-year process in order to build a national system capacity for policy research and analysis, and that is converted into through their credibility into policymaking. For example, we don't go build capacity in Korea, Japan, and those countries which have already adequate capacity in terms of policy analysts and researchers. And why? Because the local researchers have the credibility to connect their research with the policymakers. So in some of the countries that we work with, the capacity is there, but they are not connected to policymaking system, mainly because they have not shown their credibility. And sometimes they run around, do consultancies, and the quality of consultancy is not enough to take that as a serious policy material for evidence. So we need to bridge that gap in terms of bringing that, what capacity we have in terms of quality, how can we improve through collaboration. So collaborative research capacity building is a key component for long-term capacity impact as well as policy impact on the ground.
So what happens when you have short-term administration changes and here you've been working to build a policy and then you have a regime change? What then?
Absolutely. That's where the political economy issues come in understanding. We sometimes don't fully understand the political economy issues and the drivers of political economy that contributes to policy making. And that also brings us to the issue of policy continuity or policy discontinuity. The more disruptions there are in terms of the political systems, and the new government comes in and then ignores the old policies and comes up with a new policy, there is always going to be policy disruptions. But in order to understand these disruptions and expect those kind of disruptions, we need to be prepared with policy research as well as analysis. It's not that you do the research after the fact that policy is introduced. It's important to evaluate the impact and learn from the policy, but also it is important that we understand the political economy of the policy making from different ideologies and different set of policy players in the country. As the government changes, we need to anticipate and start producing the results from either from the past research and also or from the current research to guide the policy making process. So true, it is important that we recognize the policy political economy issues, but also the past research that we have done. For example, in famine research, we have been doing research on famine for several decades now, and we have solid evidence of what works, what doesn't work in the relief programs. But now the recent effort is to convert that relief into resilience and resilience into long-term development. That requires, you know, understanding the political economy of how the various governments, when they come in, treat the issues of emergencies as well as the long-term development. Understanding that, we can provide the policy material, policy research from the past research to guide the policy process.
Okay, great. We had another question come in, and I want to flag too that we're unfortunately running out of time, so we're going to move to our exit polls here while we kind of answer a few last questions. So Binyan Ayob had a couple of questions. One being your suggestions to enforce the implementation of existing policies and related metrics of success. What suggestions do you have for enforcement and metrics of success? And if you can give any specific examples.
Very good question, right? Implementation, as you will see in the kaleidoscope model that we have been researching on, using the model, is one of the stages of policy process. So, and very little researched in terms of what happens to the process of implementation. And when you actually take the policy is written in paper and it is there, and you see there is no results on the ground, mainly because you have not followed it through the implementation process. And in the implementation process, there are several weaknesses. For example, capacity is a major weakness. And what is the incentive for the people to take the policy that is on the paper, convert that into programs and projects, and support that with the investment that is needed, the budget that is needed, and monitor who is doing what and how are they doing in terms of attaining the goals that you set for yourselves in the through the strategy or the policy development is very critical. An example of that is the National Agricultural Investment Plans that we have been helping the countries to put in place. And that gives a clear roadmap on what are the things that we want to achieve, what are the indicators of the policy goals that we want to achieve, and what are the stages of implementation in which this things can happen and who will do that. So these are the metrics that we need to put in place through a roadmap like National Agriculture Investment Plan under the CADAP, for example. And it has been very useful and effective in terms of tracing the implementation challenges. But overall, we have done less work on understanding the implementation process and the difficulties in that process and fixing that process compared to the policy research and analysis itself. So more and more, as we move on to implementing policies, we need to kind of get our hands dirty in understanding the implementation challenges and what capacities are needed there and how we can and improve the governance accountability in that process so that we can hold people accountable for what has happened through the policy change on the ground and what needs to be fixed in the implementation process.
Shirish, we're at time. I'm going to ask you one last tough question that came in from our guy, which is that government authorities tend to reject research-generated evidence that can be interpreted as indicators of their own failure. How do we deal with a problem like that?
It relates to the political economy issue we talked about. Of course, if you point out things have not worked, the policymakers are not going to be happy because they are facing election next year or year after that. So it's a tricky issue. But evidence is evidence. Researchers should seek the truth. And you have to present what you find out, and maybe you can present it in a polite manner and not confrontational manner. But researchers are out there to find the truth, and we can't mend the truth for pleasing the policymakers, right? Even if there is an election coming up. But that is the role of researchers, to find the evidence. And to the extent that we apply the right models, right data, and bring out the policy options and what has happened because of the policy change, what has not happened, is going to be useful for the policymakers. May not be the person who is running for election, who is in the position right now, power right now, but maybe for the next who comes to the power, for example, to take a look at it and say what went right, what went wrong, and why. That is the fundamental objective of research. In terms of assessing the impact of whether it is pleasing to the policymakers or politicians or not, we as researchers have to provide the evidence and seek the truth.
I think that's a great place to stop. And unfortunately, we are out of time, but I really want to thank you for sharing all your wisdom on evidence-driven policymaking today and for the great engagement we've had online. I want to make a couple quick announcements here. We do have another Ask the Experts this Thursday, June 28th, on food security policy in fragile states, featuring Jeff Hill, who's the director of the Office of Economic Growth and Agriculture in USAID South Sudan. That will be held at TANAM EST. Also, please join AgriLinks and continue the conversation on food security policy this June. And in July also, we'll be talking about the enabling environment for agricultural market systems. So thank you, everyone, for tuning in. Thanks again, Shirish. Thanks, Duncan,
thank you.
Also for the engagement online. And see you at the next one.
Thank you.